The Random Selection from A Confession, by Leo Tolstoy. Only Faith Can Give Truth, by Leo Tolstoy. About the author. Leo Tolstoy, 1828-1910, orphaned at the age of 9, was reared by relatives. Following his study of Oriental languages, at the University of Kazan, Tolstoy fought as an artillery officer in the Crimean War. The beginning of his second period of his writing was marked by the selected reading below. Following his rest of life described here, Tolstoy followed the Sermon on the Mount as a guide for living, and sought a simple, humble life of regular manual work and ethical writing. About the work. A Confession, from which the following selection is drawn, marks a significant change from Tolstoy's earlier War and Peace and Anna Karenina. These works, composed during his so-called first writing period, established the Russian realistic novel as a major literary genre. However, the mental crisis described below from his later writings led to his own elucidation of the meaning of life. His writings from this period have greatly influenced subsequent utopians, pacifists, and social activists. Everyday life. Returning from there, I married. The new conditions of happy family life completely diverted me from all search for the general meaning of life. My whole life was centered at that time in my family, wife and children, and therefore in care to increase our means of livelihood. My striving after self-perfection, for which I had already substituted a striving for perfection in general, i.e. progress, was now again replaced by the effort simply to secure the best possible conditions for myself and my family. So another 15 years passed. In spite of the fact that I now regarded authorship as of no importance, the temptation of immense monetary rewards and applause for my insignificant work, and I devoted myself to it as a means of improving my material position and of stifling in my soul all questions as to the meaning of my own life, or life in general. I wrote, teaching what was for me the only truth, namely that one should live so as to have the best for oneself and one's family. So I lived, but 5 years ago something very strange began to happen to me. At first I experienced moments of perplexity and arrest of life, and though I did not know what to do or how to live, and I felt lost and became dejected. But this passed and I went on living as before. Then these moments of perplexity began to recur oftener and oftener, and always in the same form. They were always expressed by the questions, what is it for? What does it lead to? Being undermined. At first it seemed to me that these were aimless and irrelevant questions. I thought that it was all well known, and that if I should ever wish to deal with a solution, it would not cost me much effort. Just at present I had no time for it, but when I wanted to, I should be able to find the answer. The questions, however, began to repeat themselves frequently, and to demand replies more and more insistently, and like drops of ink, always falling in one place, they ran together into one black blot. Then occurred what happens to everyone, sickening with a mortal internal disease. At first trivial signs of indisposition appear, to which the sick man pays no attention, then these signs reappear more and more often, and merge into an uninterrupted period of suffering. The suffering increases, and before the sick man can look round, what he took for a mere indisposition has already become more important to him than anything else in the world. It is death. That is what happened to me. I understood that it was no casual indisposition, but something very important, and that if these questions constantly repeated themselves, they would have to be answered. And I tried to answer them. The questions seemed such stupid, simple, childish ones, but as soon as I touched them and tried to solve them, I at once became convinced, first, that they are not childish and stupid, but the most important and profound of life's questions, and secondly, that occupying myself with my Samurai state, the education of my son, or the writing of a book, one had to know why I was doing it. As long as I did not know why, I could do nothing and could not live. Amid the thoughts of estate management, which greatly occupied me at that time, the question would suddenly occur, well, you will have 6,000 desiatinas of land in Samur government, and 300 horses, and what then, and I was quite disconcerted, and did not know what to think. Or when considering plans for the education of my children, I would say to myself, what for? Or when considering how the peasants might become prosperous, I would suddenly say to myself, but what does it matter to me? Or when thinking of the fame my works would bring me, I would say to myself, very well, you will be more famous than Gogol or Pushkin or Shakespeare or Molière, or than all the writers in the world, and what of it? And I could find no reply at all. The questions would not wait, they had to be answered at once, and if I did not answer them, it was impossible to live. But there was no answer. I felt that what I had been standing in had collapsed, and that I had nothing left under my feet. What I had lived on no longer existed, and there was nothing left. And all this befell me at a time when all around me I had what is considered complete good fortune. I was not yet 50, I had a good wife, who loved me, and whom I loved, good children, and a large estate, which without much effort on my part improved and increased. I was respected by my relations and acquaintances more than at any previous time. I was praised by others, and without much self-deception, could consider that my name was famous. And far from being insane or mentally diseased, I enjoyed, on the contrary, a strength of mind and body, such as I have seldom met with among men of my kind. Physically I could keep up with the peasants at mowing, and mentally I could work for 8 and 10 hours at a stretch without experiencing any ill results from such exertion. And in this situation I came to this, that I could not live, and fearing death, had to employ cunning with myself to avoid taking my own life. My mental condition presented itself to me in this way. My life is a stupid and spiteful joke someone has played on me. Though I did not acknowledge a someone who created me, yet such a presentation that someone had played an evil and stupid joke on me by placing me in the world was the form of expression that suggested itself most naturally to me. Involuntarily it appeared to me that there somewhere was someone who amused himself by watching how I lived for 30 or 40 years, learning, developing, maturing in body and mind, and how, having with matured mental powers reached the summit of life, from which it all lay before me, I stood on that summit like an arch fool, seeing clearly that there is nothing in life, and that there has been and will be nothing. And he was amused. But whether that someone laughing at me existed or not, I was none the better off. I could give no reasonable meaning to any single action or to my whole life. I was only surprised that I could have avoided understanding this from the very beginning. It has been so long known to all. Today or tomorrow sickness and death will come. They had come already to those I love, or to me nothing will remain but stench and worms. Sooner or later my affairs, whatever they may be, will be forgotten, and I shall not exist. Then why go on making any effort? How can man fail to see this? And how go on living? That is what is surprising. One can only live while one is intoxicated with life. As soon as one is sober, it is impossible not to see that it is all a mere fraud, and a stupid fraud. That is precisely what it is. There is nothing either amusing or witty about it. It is simply cruel and stupid. Truth of death. There is an Eastern fable, told long ago, of a traveler overtaken on a plain by an enraged beast. Escaping from the beast, he gets into a dry well, but sees at the bottom of the well a dragon that has opened its jaws to swallow him. And the unfortunate man, not daring to climb out lest he should be destroyed by the enraged beast, and not daring to leap to the bottom of the well lest he should be eaten by the dragon, sees a twig growing in a crack in the well and clings to it. His hands are growing weaker, and he feels he will soon have to resign himself to the destruction that awaits him above or below, but still he clings on. Then he sees that two mice, the black one and the white one, go regularly round and round the stem of the twig to which he is clinging, and gnaw at it. And soon the twig itself will snap, and he will fall into the dragon's jaws. The traveler sees this and knows that he will inevitably perish, but while still hanging he looks around, sees some drops of honey in the leaves of the twig, reaches them with his tongue, and licks them. So I too clung to the twig of life, knowing that the dragon of death was inevitably awaiting me, ready to tear me to pieces, and I could not understand why I had fallen into such torment. I tried to lick the honey, which formerly consoled me, but the honey no longer gave me pleasure, and the white and black mice of day and night gnawed at the branch by which I hung. I saw the dragon clearly, and the honey no longer tasted sweet. I only saw the inescapable dragon and the mice, and I could not tear my gaze from them, and this is not a fable, but the real unanswerable truth intelligible to all. The deception of the joys of life, which formerly allayed my terror of the dragon, now no longer deceived me. No matter how often I may be told, you cannot understand the meaning of life, so do not think about it, but live, I can no longer do it. I have already done it too long. I cannot now help seeing day and night going round and bringing me to death. That is all I see, for that alone is true. All else is false. The 2 drops of honey, which diverted my eyes from the cruel truth longer than the rest. My love of family, and of writing art as I called it, were no longer sweet to me. Family, said I to myself. But my family, wife, and children are also human. They are placed just as I am. They must either live in a lie, or see the terrible truth. Why should they live? Why should I love them, guard them, bring them up, or watch them? That they may come to the despair that I feel, or else be stupid. Loving them, I cannot hide the truth from them. Each step in knowledge leads them to the truth. And the truth is death. Art is a decoy. Art, poetry, under the influence of success and the praise of men, I had long assured myself that this was a thing one could do, though death was drawing near. Death, which destroys all things, including my work and its remembrance. But soon I saw that that too was a fraud. It was plain to me that art is an adornment of life, an allurement to life. But life had lost its attraction for me, so how could I attract others? As long as I was not living my own life, but was born on the waves of some other life, as long as I believed that life had a meaning, though when I could not express the reflection of life, and poetry and art of all kinds afforded me pleasure. It was pleasant to look at life in the mirror of art. But when I began to seek the meaning of life, and felt the necessity of living my own life, that mirror became for me unnecessary, superfluous, ridiculous, or painful. I could no longer soothe myself with what I now saw in the mirror, namely that my position was stupid and desperate. It was all very well to enjoy the sight, when in the depth of my soul I believed that my life had a meaning. Then the play of lights, comic, tragic, touching, beautiful, and terrible in life amused me. No sweetness of honey could be sweet to me when I saw the dragon and saw the mice gnawing away my support. Nor was that all. Had I simply understood that life had no meaning, I could have borne it quietly, knowing that that was my lot. But I could not satisfy myself with that. Had I been like a man living in a wood from which he knows there is no exit, I could have lived, but I was like one lost in a wood who, horrified at having lost his way, rushes about wishing to find the road. He knows that each step he takes confuses him more and more, but still he cannot help rushing about. Science renders life meaningless. If one turns to the division of sciences, which attempt to reply to the questions of life, to physiology, psychology, biology, sociology, one encounters an appalling poverty of thought, the greatest obscurity, a quite unjustifiable pretension to solve a relevant question, and a continual contradiction of each authority, by others and even by himself. If one turns to the branches of science, which are not concerned with the solution of the questions of life, but which reply to their own special scientific questions, one is enraptured by the power of man's mind, but one knows in advance that they give no reply to life's questions. Those sciences simply ignore life's questions. They say, to the question of what you are and why you live, we have no reply, and are not occupied with that. But if you want to know the laws of light, of chemical combinations, the laws of development of organisms, if you want to know the laws of bodies, and their form, and the relation of numbers and quantities, if you want to know the laws of your mind, to all that we have clear, exact, and unquestionable replies. In general, the relation of the experimental sciences to life's question may be expressed thus. Question: why do I live? Answer: an infinite space, an infinite time, infinitely small particles change their forms in infinite complexity, and when you have understood the laws of those mutations of form, you will understand why you live on Earth. Yielding myself to the bright side of knowledge, I understood that I was only diverting my gaze from the question. However alluringly clear those horizons which opened out before me might be, however alluring it might be to immerse oneself in the limitless expanse of those sciences, I already understood that the clearer they were, the less they met my need, and the less they applied to my question. I know, said I to myself, what science so persistently tries to discover, and along that road, there is no reply to the question as to the meaning of my life. In the abstract sphere, I understood that notwithstanding the fact, or just because of the fact, that the direct aim of science is to reply to my question, there is no reply but that which I have myself already given. What is the meaning of my life? There is none. Or, what will come of my life? Nothing. Or, why does everything exist that exists, and why do I exist? Because it exists. Inquiring for one region of human knowledge, I received an innumerable quantity of exact replies concerning matters about which I had not asked. About the chemical constituents of the stars, about the movement of the sun towards the constellation Hercules, about the origin of species and of man, about the forms of infinitely minute imponderable particles of ether. But in the sphere of knowledge, the only answer to my question, what is the meaning of my life, was, you are what you call your life. You are a transitory, casual cohesion of particles. The mutual interactions and changes of these particles produce in you what you call your life. That cohesion will last some time, afterwards the interaction of these particles will cease, and what you call life will cease, and so will all your questions. You are an accidentally united little lump of something, that little lump ferments. The little lump calls that fermenting its life. The lump will disintegrate, and there will be an end of the fermenting, and of all the questions. So answers the clear sight of science, and cannot answer otherwise if it strictly follows its principles. From such a reply one sees that the reply does not answer the question. I want to know the meaning of my life, but that it is a fragment of the infinite, far from giving it a meaning, destroys its every possible meaning. The obscure compromises which that side of experimental exact science makes with abstract science, when it says that the meaning of life consists in development and in cooperation with development, owing to their inexactness and obscurity, cannot be considered as replies. Four common solutions. Not finding an explanation in science, I began to seek for it in life, hoping to find it among the people around me. And I began to observe how the people around me, people like myself, lived, and what their attitude was to this question, which had brought me to despair. And this is what I found among people who were in the same position as myself as regards education and manner of life. I found that for people of my circle there were four ways out of the terrible position in which we are all placed. The first was that of ignorance. It consists in not knowing, not understanding, that life is an evil and an absurdity. People of the sort, chiefly women, or very young, or very dull people, have not yet understood that question of life, which presented itself to Schopenhauer, Solomon, and Buddha. They see neither the dragon that awaits them, nor the mice gnawing the shrub by which they are hanging, and they lick the drops of honey, but they lick those drops of honey only for a while. Something will turn their attention to the dragon and the mice, and there will be an end to their licking. From them I had nothing to learn. One cannot cease to know what one does know. The second way out is Epicureanism. It consists, while knowing the hopelessness of life, in making use meanwhile of the advantages one has, disregarding the dragon and the mice, and licking the honey in the best way, especially if there is much of it within reach. Solomon expresses this way out thus: then I commended mirth, because a man hath no better thing under the sun than to eat, and to drink, and to be merry, and that this should accompany him in his labor the days of his life, which God giveth him under the sun. The third escape is that of strength and energy. It consists in destroying life, when one has understood that it is an evil and an absurdity. A few exceptionally strong and consistent people act so. Having understood the stupidity of the joke that has been played on them, and having understood that it is better to be dead than to be alive, and that it is best of all not to exist, they act accordingly, and promptly end the stupid joke, since there are means. A rope round one's neck, water, a knife to stick into one's heart, or the trains on the railways, and the number of those of our circle who act in this way becomes greater and greater, and for the most part, they act so at the best time of their life, when the strength of their mind is in full bloom, and few habits degrading to the mind have as yet been acquired. I saw that this was the worthiest way of escape, and I wished to adopt it. The fourth way out is that of weakness. It consists in seeing the truth of the situation, and yet clinging to life, knowing in advance that nothing can come of it. People of this kind know that death is better than life, but not having the strength to act rationally to end the deception quickly and kill themselves, they seem to wait for something. This is the escape of weakness, for if I know what is best, and it is within my power, why not yield to what is best? I found myself in that category. So people of my class evade the terrible contradiction in four ways. Strain my attention as I would, I saw no way except those four. I long lived in the state of lunacy, which in fact, if not in words, is particularly characteristic of us very liberal and learned people. But thanks either to the strange physical affection I have for the real laboring people, which compelled me to understand them and to see that they are not so stupid as we suppose, or thanks to the sincerity of my conviction that I could know nothing beyond the fact that the best I could do was to hang myself, at any rate I instinctively felt that if I wished to live and understand the meaning of life, I must seek this meaning not among those who have lost it and wish to kill themselves, but among those myriads of the past and the present who make life and who support the burden of their own lives and of ours also. And I consider the enormous masses of those simple and learned and poor people who have lived and are living, and I saw something quite different. I saw that with rare exceptions, all those myriads who have lived and are living do not fit into my divisions, and that I could not class them as not understanding the question, for they themselves state it and reply to it with extraordinary clearness. Nor could I consider them epicureans, for their life consists more of privations and sufferings than of enjoyments. Still less could I consider them as irrationally dragging in a meaningless existence, for every act of their life, as well as death itself, is explained by them. To kill themselves they consider the greatest evil. It appeared that all mankind had a knowledge, unacknowledged and despised by me, of the meaning of life. It appeared that reasonable knowledge does not give the meaning of life, but excludes life, while the meaning attributed to life, by myriads of people, by all humanity, rests on some despised pseudo-knowledge. Rational knowledge is indefinite. My position was terrible. I knew I could find nothing along the path of reasonable knowledge, except a denial of life, and therein faith was nothing but a denial of reason, which was yet more impossible for me than a denial of life. From rational knowledge, it appeared that life is an evil. People know this and it is in their power to end life, yet they lived and still alive, and I myself live, though I have long known that life is senseless and an evil. By faith it appears that in order to understand the meaning of life I must renounce my reason, the very thing for which alone a meaning is required. A contradiction arose from which there were two exits. Either that which I called reason was not so rational as I supposed, or that which seemed to me irrational was not so rational as I supposed. And I began to verify the line of argument of my rational knowledge. Verifying the line of argument of rational knowledge, I found it quite correct. The conclusion that life is nothing was inevitable, but I noticed a mistake. The mistake lay in this, that my reasoning was not in accord with the question I had put. The question was, why should I live? That is to say, what real permanent result will come out of my illusory, transitory life? What meaning has my finite existence in this infinite world? And to reply to that question I had studied life. The solution of all the possible questions of life could evidently not satisfy me, for my question, simple as it at first appeared, included a demand for an explanation of the finite in terms of the infinite, and vice versa. I asked, what is the meaning of my life, beyond time, cause, and space? And I replied to quite another question, what is the meaning of my life, within time, cause, and space? With the result that after long efforts of thought, the answer I reached was, none. In my reasonings I constantly compared, nor could I do otherwise, the finite with the finite, and the infinite with the infinite, but for that reason I reached the inevitable result. Force is force, matter is matter, will is will, the infinite is infinite, nothing is nothing, and that was all that could result. It was something like what happens in mathematics, when thinking to solve an equation, we find we are working on an identity, the line of reasoning is correct, but results in the answer, that A equals A, or X equals X, or Phi equals Phi. The same thing happened with my reasoning in relation to the question of the meaning of my life. The replies given by all science to that question only result in identity. And really, strictly scientific knowledge, that knowledge which begins, as Descartes did, with complete doubt about everything, rejects all knowledge admitted in faith and builds everything afresh on the laws of reason and experience, and cannot give any other reply to the question of life than that which I obtained, an indefinite reply. Only at first had it seemed to me that knowledge had given a positive reply, the reply of Schopenhauer, that life has no meaning and is an evil. But on examining the matter I understood that the reply is not positive, it was only my feeling that so expressed it. Strictly expressed, as it is by the Brahmins, and by Solomon and Schopenhauer, the reply is merely indefinite, or an identity. Ampersand PhGr equals ampersand PhGr, life is nothing. So that philosophic knowledge denies nothing, but only replies that the question cannot be solved by it, that for it, the solution remains indefinite. Faith's solution. Having understood this, I understood that it was not possible to seek in rational knowledge for a reply to my question, and that the reply given by rational knowledge is a mere indication that a reply can only be obtained by a different statement of the question, and only when the relation of the finite to the infinite is included in the question. And I understood that, however irrational and distorted might be the replies given by faith, they have this advantage, that they introduce into a very answer a relation between the finite and the infinite, without which there can be no solution. In whatever way I stated the question, that relation appeared in the answer. How am I to live according to the law of God? What real result will come of my life? Eternal torment or eternal bliss? What meaning has life, that death does not destroy union with eternal God, heaven? So that besides rational knowledge, which had seemed to me the only knowledge, I was inevitably brought to acknowledge that all live humanity has another irrational knowledge, faith, which makes it possible to live. Faith still remained to me as irrational as it was before, but I could not but admit that it alone gives mankind a reply to the questions of life, and that consequently it makes life possible. Reasonable knowledge had brought me to acknowledge that life is senseless, my life had come to a halt, and I wished to destroy myself. Looking around on the whole of mankind, I saw that people live and declare that they know the meaning of life. I looked at myself, I had lived as long as I knew a meaning of life, and had made life possible. Looking again at people of other lands, at my contemporaries, and at their predecessors, I saw the same thing. Where there is life, there since man began faith has made life possible for him, and the chief outline of that faith is everywhere, and always identical. Whatever the faith may be, and whatever answers it may give, and to whomsoever it gives them, a very such answer gives to the finite existence of man an infinite meaning, a meaning not destroyed by sufferings, deprivations, or death. This means that only in faith can we find for life a meaning and a possibility. What then is this faith? And I understood that faith is not merely the evidence of things not seen, etc., and is not a revelation that defines only one of the indications of faith, is not the relation of man to God. One has first to define faith, and then God, and not define faith through God. It not only agreement with what has been told one as faith is most usually supposed to be, but faith is a knowledge of the meaning of human life, in consequence of which, man does not destroy himself, but lives. Faith is the strength of life. If a man lives, he believes in something. If he did not believe that one must live for something, he would not live. If he does not see and recognize the illusory nature of the finite, he believes in the finite. If he understands the illusory nature of the finite, he must believe in the infinite. Without faith, he cannot live. This completes the retinue of only faith, can give truth a selection. Selection from A Confession by Leo Tolstoy, under the new free documentation license. This file in this and other formats is available on the internet at philosophy.lander.edu.